Right, okay, so there was this terrible time at the end of the 19th century where the movement was completely divided because some people were happy to use rather racist arguments to support the idea of women getting the vote, and other people would not. And this was around the amendment to the Constitution which said that black men could have the right to vote. And so you had one section of the women's movement saying, well, it's a step forward. And another section of the women's movement saying, black men are inferior to white women. That's a big division. And they came back together again 20 years later. The problem of splitting a movement is it sometimes takes 20 years to get back together. In 1890, the National Association, and one of the leaders was Carrie Chapman Catt. And they had this debate between two possible tactics. Number one, try to get a constitutional amendment, like there was a constitutional amendment for the vote for black men. And if you have a constitutional amendment, all of the states must follow. But you need a large number of states to get a constitutional amendment. I think it's 3/4. Or, on the other hand, maybe fight one state at a time. So send the maximum number of activists to one state, you know, from all over the country to campaign to win in that state and then another state. So state by state solution. So Carrie Chapman Catt was in favour of this state by state strategy. She was also in favour of identifying with President Wilson. President Wilson was not giving the vote to women, but he was more sympathetic than the opposition. And so, according to Carrie Chapman Catt, the best thing to do is to support him. Difficult questions. Some other people said, no, Wilson is the worst. Because he says he's sympathetic to women's suffrage, but he isn't doing it. So let's campaign against Wilson. So again, these are political tactical differences, which are always very complicated. First of all, it's complicated to make the right decision. And secondly, it's very complicated afterwards to know whether you've made the right decision or not. And finally, also very, very classic, Carrie Chapman Catt was rather in favour of acting ladylike. Yeah, let's not break any windows. No, yeah, let's not attack property. Let's try to show to the elites that we are ladylike, respectable women who deserve the votes. And of course, some other people say, no, it's good to break a few windows. It gets you in the newspapers. So these are debates which we still see today, in many radical movements. On the other wing of the movement was Alice Paul, who established the National Women's Party. So this is a completely different tactic. Let's have a separate party. So we're not worrying about the Democratic Party and persuading the Democratic Party. No, they're all the same. Let's have a separate party for women's rights, the National Women's Party. She was more... Now, it's very important when you call an organisation a party, that means that you have a general set of policies for the nation. Yeah, a movement or a campaign might be about one question, but a party is a general set of policies. This is what the National Woman's Party put forward as tactics. First of all, they focused on passing a constitutional amendment. They said, we don't want to win one state at a time. This is a principle which must be taken by the whole nation. And if it takes a bit longer, that's just too bad. Secondly, they followed the British suffragists who, after 1902, had moved into direct action, hunger strikes, burning letterboxes. These are the letterboxes in the streets, which are very easy to burn, of course, because they're everywhere. And remember, at the time, before telephones, before the generalisation of telephones, before the internet, the letterboxes were extremely valuable. All the nation's business went through the letterboxes. And so burning the letterboxes was a really big deal. And of course, there are too many of them for the police to protect. So this was a big tactic in Britain for the suffragettes. And indeed, Alice Paul will follow some of these. Logically enough, then, she would refuse to support President Wilson because he didn't, if he didn't do women's suffrage, she was not interested in his positions on other questions. And the National Women's Party members were often ended up in jail, on hunger strike, force-fed, and the sort of things which we know about, or perhaps you know about, from the British movement. And this was particularly in 1917, there was a big picket in front of the White House, and they were arrested. Yeah, force-feeding is a particularly horrible thing. Where I will not be showing you pictures. We do have pictures, but I won't be showing you pictures. Here you can see a procession from March the 3rd, 1913, so a demonstration. But you can see the kind of imagery they've chosen. Very decorated. This is a kind of medieval crusade, perhaps. And here is the castle they are going to storm. And this is the idea. So very grand, very grandiose, the women's suffrage procession from March 1913. And here is the national... So this was more the kind of action carried out by the National Suffrage Association and Carrie Chapman Catt. And this is more the kind of action carried out by the National Women's Party. Notice that they say, yet Wilson is against women. Because President Wilson said, votes for women is a very good idea, but you need to leave us some time. That was the line of... We don't have any time. So Wilson is against women was their slogan. Vote against Wilson. President Wilson, how long do you advise us to wait? So you can see this other tactic here for the US women's movement. Now, the right to vote was not the only... right which was being fought for at this time. A second very important aspect in every country is the right to decide how many children you have. And in Britain, Margaret Sanger was a pioneer of the campaign for the right to contraception. And she was quite an impressive lady. She went onto the streets of, I think it was New York, and she gave out leaflets. Then, contraception information. And of course, she was arrested and put in prison because this was illegal. Yeah. So she did, many people at the time tried to discreetly give out information about contraception. But Margaret Sanger was a political person. She said, okay, I get arrested, I go to jail. Then I could talk to some journalists. Yeah. Powerful and risky strategy. So she was a leader in the birth control movement. And she was convinced that family planning was a necessary step in social progress. At one point, she established clinics. She got some doctors, men doctors, because there were almost no women doctors. She got some doctors and established clinics in different parts of town. And one thing which is very notable at this time, because, of course, racism was even worse at this time, Margaret Sanger worked very hard to also have clinics with black doctors in the black parts of town and not just have a movement for white women. And in the 1920s, this was incredible, incredibly good example. She was arrested in 1915 for sending birth control information through the mail. She sent a letter with information about birth control, and this was illegal under the pornography laws. Okay, what she did is she wrote this letter and she spoke to her. I'm going to send this letter with birth control information to my friend in Washington. You know, she wanted to do it publicly. And so she was arrested so that in the tribunal she could give a speech and make some noise about it. These are pretty impressive people, I think. And also, Margaret Sanger, I think she's been she's been almost completely forgotten. Did you know the name Margaret Sanger, anybody? Yeah, no, I think she'd been forgotten, yeah, which is a pity. She was also arrested for conducting a birth control clinic in Brooklyn in 1916. And the clinic she opened in 1923 was still open in 1970. So it lasted for quite a long time. This is information about contraception. That's all it's about at this time. She established the National Committee on Federal Legislation for Birth Control, and this organisation continues today under the name Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood. Yeah. You have in English, of course, you have the two words, the Latin word and the Saxon word: maternity, motherhood; paternity, fatherhood; fraternity, brotherhood, etc. And this is parenthood. And you can see here an example then of the birth control review from the 1920s, I think. Yeah, how shall we change the law? Although this is a nurse, and this is supposed to be a poor woman saying, please give me information. Yeah, so it's a little bit of a traditional view, but you know, the birth control review, and this was extremely controversial at the time. Naturally enough, Margaret Sanger came from a family with some money, because it was very hard for any women to organise on this, and poor women, it was just even harder. Yeah, so it's not, we're not surprised when some of the leaders come from the elite, because you know it was just impossible otherwise. But you do have a statue of Margaret Sanger, and here you have this lovely statue of Margaret Sanger in a church in Boston today, and you can see that she has her mouth tied, that she's not allowed to speak. I don't know a lot about her, but she's one of my heroines. And finally, we got somewhere in 1920, a constitutional amendment, the 19th Amendment. Finally, it was the constitutional amendment method which worked out: the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. That is to say, the women already had the right in some states, but after the Constitution was changed, every state must follow. That's the Constitution. It's this the big over thing, shall not be. You see this, just a little bit of un petit peu de grammaire. Vous voyez l'utilisation traditionnelle de shall for an order. Yeah, as in the Ten Commandments. Yeah, yeah. Thou shalt not kill. Yeah, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods, etc. Yes. At this time, in order to ratify, to approve, to validate a constitutional amendment at this time, you needed 36 states. It's quite a lot. And finally, Tennessee was the 36th, and it passed by only one vote, which means there were quite a number of states who were not really happy. State governments were not really happy with it, but they were obliged to follow. There you go, Margaret Sanger then, having a meeting in 1917. Je pense que j'ai mélangé l'ordre des diapos. Mais si vous ne dites rien, je dirai rien. So let's go on to a few firsts. I can't do these in great details, but a few firsts. There's a very, very long list of firsts. The first woman to do this. And this list is not finished. There are still things today which no woman has ever managed to do. But there are fewer and fewer. So the first woman state senator, 1922. Moi, je dirais que vous n'avez pas besoin de tous mémoriser, mais il faudrait en avoir plusieurs que vous pouvez sortir. Donc si je vous donne une vingtaine, tant que vous avez cinq pour sortir à l'examen, c'est bon, quoi. C'est pas un test de mémorisation. 1935, then. Although quite naturally, the first women's movements were established by white women because life was so much harder for black women. Nevertheless, the black women's movement goes back a long time. 1935, And it is Mary McLeod Bethune who founds the National Council of Negro Women, which was the vocabulary they used at the time. You can imagine that it was even harder to organise black women because the social handicap was so great. Sasidili Pokwon Sabi Sabiya. No? Okay. Yeah. Look, they all have... They don't have socks. Never mind. 1949, first woman ambassador. Yeah, so these are firsts. Now, of course, most people will never be an ambassador. Most people will never meet an ambassador. So it's an elite post. It's not for most people. But symbolically, it's quite important. The interests of the United States abroad can also be defended by women. Now, this is a very important symbolic thing. And as you can see, I've stolen the photograph. The very first, in 1955, this is again landmarks, you got the founding of this organization. Now, it's not very transparent for you, except you can read it. This is the first lesbian magazine in America. That's why it's a landmark. The Ladder monthly magazine of articles, stories, poems, book reviews, quotes, comments, and significant opinion on sexual problems facing the lesbian in society today. Published by the Daughters of Bilitis. It must be a mythological figure. I don't know who it is. Non-profit educational research and social services organization. And the last sentence is the most interesting one. Subscriptions mailed in sealed plain envelope. Yeah. If you receive this magazine in your home, it will say nothing on the outside of the envelope. It will not say what it is, yeah? Because this is still a magazine people want to receive secretly. So the thing. Of course, that's a long time back. Quite early, really, compared with Britain, for example. Other landmarks are perhaps less institutionally important, but symbolically quite important. In 1957, Decoy, policewoman, was the first television series with a woman policewoman hero, a policewoman heroine. Yeah, all of the television series have always had men, and this was the first woman hero as the leader. Although you can see that Decoy was an interesting title. That meant the advantage of a policewoman is that nobody would imagine. The advantage of a woman is that nobody would imagine that it could be a policewoman, and so you can send her to places where you need secrecy. If you find this on the web, it's really great series. Great series. To get back to the intellectual side, because the whole thing about defending women in a movement, there's always been the practical side, the organisation side, lots of sides. And the intellectual side has a certain importance, and the publication in 1963 of Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, which became an international bestseller. D'ailleurs, ça a été traduit en français. This became an international bestseller, and it spoke about how the romanticization of women, the idealization of the romanticization of women, transforming them into something not very human, was damaging society. And we have here a couple of very short quotes from this book by Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique. This was a difficult book to write at the time. She was insulted by many people in many newspapers. So first of all, each suburban wife struggles with it alone. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slip-covered material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies. That's brownies, Lee. It's in the... Les petits garçons, ça peut être des nouveautés. Et les petites filles, c'est quoi? Vous savez, dans les scouts, les petits garçons, c'est des louveteaux. Vous ne saviez pas, d'accord. Et les filles? Les Jeannettes, voilà, merci. Je savais. C'est un truc du 20e siècle, c'est pas grave. OK. The lay beside her husband at night, she was afraid to ask even of herself the silent question, is this all? Yeah, they're talking about what is presented as the ideal for American woman. Find a nice husband with a good job, look after your children, but don't go to work. Don't try to develop yourself intellectually, because you're there to be a mother. And the question behind it, is this all? Yeah. The feminine mystique has succeeded in burying millions of American women alive. And then finally, a comment. I don't know if it's really true, but finally a comment about women's rights for later generations. She says, rights have a dull sound to people who have grown up after they have been won. C'est-à-dire, la question des droits des femmes, ça semble un sujet super ennuyeux aux femmes qui ont été nées après que ces droits ont été gagnés. Je crois que peut-être elle exagère un peu, mais bon, voilà. The feminine mystique. Other progress made, 1963 Equal Pay Act. So it became illegal to pay women less. This is before Britain. Britain was 1970, the Equal Pay Act of 1970. Now, this takes a little time, because even when you have a law, companies are relatively good at avoiding the law in clever ways. But nevertheless, having the law is important. And you can see that there, holding the banner, you have a lady and a gentleman. These were campaigns which had some support from male allies. 1965, I just chose this highlight because I wanted to choose a big variety. And in 1965, Rachel Henderlite was the first woman ordained as a Presbyterian minister. Religious ministers. Now, of course, yeah, if you're not religious, you might not care. But symbolically, this is obviously extremely important. If you believe in God and you believe that ministers give out the word of God, it's obviously a big block if they're only men. There's obviously something there. Now, this has caused more difficulty in the Catholic religion, because the Catholic religion has very developed theological reasons to not have women priests, and they don't seem to be moving very much. Whereas some other churches are, for example, the Church of England, not in America, but the Church of England, now has 20% of its priests are women. So yeah, so the things have been moving here. Fascinating advances there. And here we have then a Supreme Court case. This is a Supreme Court case. Perhaps you know, if you win a case in the Supreme Court, then every state must respect it. Yeah. In this case, we had in Connecticut, in one state, there was a law which made contraception illegal. So in some states it was legal, in some states it was illegal. A lady called Griswold went to the tribunals, and then the higher tribunals, and you know, 3 years later, they arrived at the Supreme Court. This case, Griswold versus Connecticut, she won. And so after this case, no state could ban contraception anymore. That's how the Constitution works. Yeah. So this was a big one. They're often questions of Supreme Court cases. In June the 30th, 1966, was the foundation of the National Organization for Women. This still exists today. And it's an interesting, notice the name, National Organization for Women. They don't use the word party, because their objective is not to be an alternative to the Democratic Party. It is to pressurize all the parties. And here we have a nice symbolic one. And this is 1966. This is Bobby Gibb. And there you can see her in the middle. And what she is doing is she is running the marathon. Say again? Yes, that's right. Yeah. This is an interesting case, because these are, you know, this is like the public marathons, you know, where you get a load of people who are not really very good at running, but who run a marathon. Yeah. I've always dreamed of doing this, but I never have done. But every now and then I see a television program saying he's 96 and he's run his first marathon. So I'm waiting. So, in fact, what was interesting is in the rules of the Boston Marathon, it didn't say anything about men or women, because everybody knew that only men would come and run the marathon. And Bobby, that's her name, if you listen to her name, Bobby, it could be a man, it could be a woman. So she wrote in by letter and received permission, but without saying she was a woman. And then on the day, she ran it, and it was very hard because there were people insulting her while she ran it. And also, she was not a very good runner. And she was thinking, oh, I'm not going to make it. And of course, symbolically, it was very, very important that she made it. Anyway, she made it, you know, so good for her. And this caused a big, you know, her bride, first gal to run marathon. Vous remarquez que dans le titre, il souligne qu'elle était mariée. C'est un petit peu, il faudrait que son mari s'occupe de son cas. So really, really, again, this is, it's just a marathon, but some of these symbolic moments are pretty, pretty important. You can find the clip on YouTube. Yes, these are less interesting. These are some court cases which make it more difficult for companies to avoid the Equal Pay Act. I'm not going to read through them. They're not quite so interesting. The founding of MS Magazine in 1972. And you can see what they're writing about, yes. Raising kids without sex roles. Women tell the truth about their abortion, etc. And here you have the presentation of an Eastern goddess. But, of course, having to do all these different things at work, cooking, at home, and also having a baby at the same time. Now, the name of this magazine is an interesting point, because this is of course the title, which we pronounce as Ms. And originally this was invented by the feminist movement. We don't want to say Mrs. or Miss. Mrs. if you're married, Miss if you're not married, because it's not fair. If it's a man, we just say Mr., whether he's married or not. So there is no reason to have Mrs. or Miss to distinguish. And so they invented a new expression, Ms., and received many insults. But what is interesting is that this is now generalized. Now, that is quite important, because if you decide you want to change the language, generally, you do not succeed. It is extremely difficult to. And in official notices and forms in America and in Britain and in Australia, Mr. or Ms. Now, I know that this has been going on in France, and in general, the solution in France has been to apply Madame to all women. Yeah, you've seen this. Vous entendez encore, mademoiselle? Ah, c'est fréquemment, non? Je sais que parmi les profs, on a eu une petite discussion et on essaie d'encourager les gens de dire madame à tout le monde. Pas tout le monde, que aux filles. C'est pas si évident aussi parce qu'on est vieux. Alors, ça nous fait un peu bizarre. Tout comme moi pour les gars, j'ai tendance à dire jeune homme. Bon, ça fait papy, hein, mais bon, hein, c'est pas... Ça m'arrive de dire mademoiselle accidentellement. Voilà. Okay, so the history of Ms. And the first black woman's magazine, 1970, Essence. Je comprends pas tout là, en fait, parce que là c'est marqué. How to peep your man's program. Je comprends pas ce qu'il. Je comprends pas ce que veut faire avec son programme. Peut-être il vaut mieux de pas en parler parmi des jeunes adultes. Does he what to you? I have no idea, okay. Fashion, beauty, divorce. Dazzling ideas for windows. Il ne s'agit pas du logiciel. Il s'agit des fenêtres, c'est 1960. This is an interesting one, divorce, two women's experiences, because this is still a time when divorce is very, very shameful. Very, very shameful. Je me rappelle que quand j'étais jeune en Angleterre, dans les années 70, on ne disait pas famille monoparentale. Single parent family, Et vous allez jamais deviner ce qu'on disait. Broken home, foyer brisé. Ah, il vient d'un foyer brisé. C'est comme un peu marqué comme expression. Hein. Alors, vous imaginez à l'école. Levez la main si vous venez d'un foyer brisé. That was not so long ago. Well, okay, it's a long time ago, but you know, still within living memory. Within living memory. And the first Chicana feminist magazine in 1973. Yeah, the Chicana of Mexican origin. Of Mexican origin. Encuentro femenino. Femenil. Encuentro femenil. Now, after the 1920 constitutional amendment making it unconstitutional to stop women from voting, there was another campaign for a constitutional amendment. And this constitutional amendment, the Equal Rights Amendment, would make it illegal for any state to discriminate, for any state to pass any law which discriminated against women and in favour of men. Any law at all. And the Congress, the Parliament, if you like, they voted it, but there were not enough states to ratify it. There were a slightly higher number of states in 1972 than there had been in 1920, and therefore it was necessary to have 38 states, so they did not succeed, and indeed the Equal Rights Amendment has not been passed and does not exist. It was a 20-year campaign which did not succeed. I think the reason it's not succeeded today, despite other successes, is that many people think it's no longer necessary. I'm not saying they're right, but it was difficult to get a mass campaign going for that reason. Another Supreme Court, a famous Supreme Court decision, Roe versus Wade. They're always identified in that way, Machin versus Truc, Roe versus Wade, and they decided High Court rules abortion legal the first 3 months. That is to say that because of this Supreme Court win, every state must allow abortion in the first 3 months of pregnancy. Of course, different states have different laws, but they must do that because that's the Supreme Court. It comes down from above. There you go, Roe versus Wade. So this is Jane Roe. So at the time the case was run under her pseudonym, because it's very dangerous. And she wanted an abortion which was illegal in Texas at the time, unless the mother's life was in danger. And she took it to court and went up the courts a long time, years and years. Yeah, and then it arrived at the Supreme Court, and it was Roe versus Wade. Now this is tremendously symbolic. Every time a Supreme Court judge dies and they nominate another, all of the journalists want to know, what do they think of Roe versus Wade? Yeah? Is there a possibility that they will support reversing the legalization of abortion? Yeah? And so that's always a very, very big big question there. There have been a lot of cases where they change a little bit, you know, so they allow some restrictions on abortion or other restrictions on abortion, so different in different states, and regularly the Supreme Court has to decide them. Perhaps you know that if you are appointed to the Supreme Court, c'est pas très probable que vous soyez nommé à la Cour suprême, on sait jamais. It is a nomination for life. Many people stay on the Supreme Court until they die. I can't remember how many judges there are on the Supreme Court. I think it's 9, but I'm not sure. And you are nominated for life. You can retire if you wish, but you cannot be sacked. This is in order to guarantee the independence of the judges. So the judges are nominated by the president, who is lucky enough to be president when a judge dies. Yeah? So it's kind of lucky or unlucky. And you do find Democratic judges with Democratic sympathy try very hard not to die while Trump is in power. It's a bit gruesome, isn't it? It's a bit gory, but there you go. That's how it goes. And in 1981, Sandra Day O'Connor became the first woman Supreme Court judge. In 1983, Sally Ride became the first woman astronaut. Again, these are all very much minority activities, but it's symbolism. It's symbolism there. And so you can see that Ms. Magazine is still doing well there. Now,
on July 7th, 2009.
Now, you know that last year in France was the Women's Soccer World Cup, the Women's Football World Cup.
Yes. The problem is they are underpaid than soccer men.
They're certainly paid less than male soccer players, yeah. They're still paid a lot of money, so I must admit I find it a little difficult to get too worked up about this. But the Women's World Cup, the World Football Cup is every 4 years, and last year it was in France. Where was the previous one?
In Japan.
Thank you. Thank you. Did anybody else know? No. You knew? That's great. I'll cheer up. Moi, j'avais l'impression que l'année dernière c'est la première fois qu'on a beaucoup parlé, quoi. I don't know. Now, even in Britain, yeah, it's the first time really they... let's say that we talk more and more about women's football. Yeah, certainly, 20 years ago, nobody knew it existed. And again, this is certainly in a country like Britain, this is extremely important, because if you don't play football, you're not really human in general. You know, it's so I just thought to give my voice a break. We have a little video, the untold truth of the U.S. women's soccer team.
19, it happened again. The U.S. women's national soccer team delighted fans and thumbed its nose at the naysayers by winning their fourth World Cup in a feat of rarely seen sports dominance. What's their secret sauce? Here's a look at the franchise that became 2019's greatest team in the world. The U.S. women's national team's tally of records is getting so impressive that Good Morning America called the team's reign a, quote, dynasty. And Megan Rapinoe happily accepted the turn of phrase.
Do you like that word, dynasty?
Yeah, it's too good to get to put it on. So this team, I think, fits well into that word.
The assessment is hard to argue. The U.S. has now won 4 of the 8 FIFA Women's World Cups, and, like Germany, has managed to win 2 consecutive titles. Their 13 goals against Thailand in the 2019 World Cup group stage are the most goals the team has scored in a Women's World Cup match, and their total of 26 goals in the tournament is also a record. The Thailand match is also the highest margin of victory in the history of the World Cup, men's tournament included. When you look into the team's personal records, things get doubly impressive. Apart from Rapinoe taking home the Golden Boot for best scorer and the Golden Ball for best player in the tournament, Jill Ellis became the first coach to win 2 Women's World Cup titles. And striker Alex Morgan's 5 goals in a single match, yes, against poor Thailand, tied her for a record for most individual goals in a single game. The only other person holding that record, U.S. soccer legend Michelle Akers.
There's always talk, oh, who's the best player in the world?
I just wanted to ask you a question. Just have a little think. Approximately how many international male football players can you name?
Okay, si chacun réfléchit un instant. Vous connaissez le nom de combien de joueurs de foot international hommes et puis le nom de combien de femmes à peu près, hein?
20 men and let's say 4.
20 men and 4 women, very good. I think I've got 5 men and 1 woman. But, you know, I'm not really a football person. Anybody?
Close.
How many men football players can you name?
More than
2 or 3, yeah.
No,
16. Okay. Yeah? How many can you name? Not very many. Okay. Well, this is you get some names here then. Because my American friends can name a lot of them.
Go, I don't really care. That's not the most important thing to me.
As dominant as the U.S. women's national soccer team might seem right now, the tides could soon be changing. As CNBC reports, soccer has been a popular sport for U.S. women for a long time, So the talent pool has been massive compared to other countries. However, Europe in particular is rapidly gaining on its stateside opponents, and the increasing number of eyes on women's soccer will only further grease the wheels. Europe is churning out many high-quality women's soccer leagues, and even previously adverse giants like Spain's Real Madrid are now putting the focus on women's teams. England's Women's Super League announced a $12.5 million sponsorship from Barclays in 2019, which is a pretty clear signal for increased sponsor interest. And CNN reports that European soccer federations have also dramatically increased their spending on the women's game in recent years.
Now it's our turn.
All this may not be enough to dethrone the US in the short term, since they already have a pretty decent head start, not to mention that giant talent pool to guarantee the emergence of new top players. Still, the next World Cup might feature an increasingly level playing field. If you followed the U.S. women's national soccer team in 2019, you may have noticed that they're vocal about the concept of equal pay, but they're taking things quite a bit further than the occasional pointed interview and crowd chant. As CNN reports, a few months before the World Cup, 28 members of the U.S. team filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation, claiming that the significant pay gap between them and the men's team is discriminatory, and demanding equal support, funding, working conditions, and cash.
Why on earth wouldn't we pay people equally?
It's easy to see why the women are serious about this. They are paid less than the men, despite the fact that the women draw more accolades, ratings, and revenue. The avenue they've chosen through which to pursue this is characteristically gutsy, too. Imagine suing your own sports federation mere months before the most important tournament in 4 years. Then imagine pushing all that aside to win said tournament and immediately use your victory as evidence for your case, which the plaintiff's spokeswoman Molly Levinson did as soon as they got their medals. With such sheer will to win, the U.S. women's team might just give the federation a run for its literal money. As the Daily Beast attests, U.S. women's national soccer team winger Rapinoe doesn't shy away from activism, to the point that she has described herself as a, quote, walking protest to the current U.S. administration.
Excited about going to the White House?
I'm going to the White House. No, I'm not going to the White House.
According to ABC 13, she is also spearheading equal pay for female footballers and managed to draw worried smiles and vague promises of future talks from FIFA big shots during the trophy presentation, which also featured chants of, quote, equal pay by fans in the stands. Still, just because the activism talk has been focused on Rapinoe doesn't mean the rest of the team isn't in on it. As NBC News puts it, the World Cup winners are now, quote, embracing a frontline role in social justice causes in ways few other sports teams ever have. They're all obviously on board with the equal pay thing. When Rapinoe drew the ire of President Donald Trump with her comments that she wouldn't go to the White House if invited, the rest of the team stood by her. The team has also become a powerful symbol of LGBTQ inclusiveness, as 5 squad members, including Allie Krieger and Ashlyn Harris, who are engaged to each other, and coach Jill Ellis, are all openly gay. The U.S. women's national soccer team has drawn much ire and criticism, to the point where they've almost been cast as the villains of women's soccer. They have been criticized for their goal celebrations and their enthusiasm over winning by a huge margin. Posters featuring star player Megan Rapinoe, an openly gay human rights activist who has feuded with President Donald Trump, have been vandalized with hate speech. Foreign media such as the Irish Examiner have even been known to call the team, quote, arrogant, entitled, and self-centered, and, ironically, Trumpian.
The team no one can walk away from. The team everyone wants to take down.
As CNN points out, the U.S. women's perceived antagonistic status is actually good for the sport, and it's all because their swaggering displays of dominance, joyful celebrations, and unapologetic attitude in the face of demands for humility, not to mention their noting that male players wouldn't be hassled for wild celebrations, managed to draw virtually unprecedented attention to the Women's World Cup. It also created tons of discussion about the tournament and the equality issues surrounding it. As for the players themselves, well, their World Cup win clearly shows that the team couldn't be less bothered with whatever strange villain role some people seem determined to cast them in. The 2019 team may be fresh on everyone's mind right now, but they aren't the first U.S. team to dominate the world and impress soccer experts. Just like the legendary FC Barcelona MSN trio of Lionel Messi, Luis Suarez, and Neymar, few things set the soccer fans' heart ablaze like a team with an unstoppable attacking trio. And as FIFA notes, the U.S. women's national soccer team featured one of these legendary forward lines, in the form of Karen Jennings-Cabrera, Michelle Akers, and April Heinrichs. This unstoppable trio was integral during the U.S. women's team's victorious 1991 World Cup campaign in China. They were so destructive that they produced a whopping 20 of the team's 25 goals in the tournament, and so thoroughly impressive that the enamored Chinese media started calling them the quote, triple-edged sword. Jennings Cabrera, who won the Golden Ball for the best player of the tournament, attributes a lot of the triple-edged sword success to the fact that the U.S. was one of the first teams that started deploying three forwards on the pitch. She told FIFA.com, "It was a different style for other teams, and they didn't know how to handle that or how to react to it because they had never seen something like it before." As ESPN puts it, the U.S. women's national soccer team is one of those squads that are simply so strong, they enter every tournament with expectations of victory and consider anything less a failure. This is why the U.S. team's results in the 2000s, when they were unable to reach the Women's World Cup Finals in both 2003 and 2007, were considered disappointing, despite the fact that the team took third place in both tournaments. The limbo wouldn't end until 2015, 16 years after their last World Cup win. At that point on, ESPN was talking about a full-on drought and analyzing the failures of the previous decade. In their opinion, the 2003 campaign was a mess of mistakes, injuries, and bad luck that culminated in a key defense error against Germany and subsequent defeat. The big mistake of 2007, on the other hand, was easier to spot. The strange benching of goalkeeper Hope Solo in favor of backup goalie Brianna Scurry for an important semifinal game against Brazil led to a number of goals that at least Solo herself is sure she would have saved. A good team is nothing without a great coach, and in Jill Ellis, the U.S. women's national soccer team has more than it needs to win, win, and win some more. As CNN reports, Ellis comes from a soccer household. Her father ran a soccer academy, and Ellis spent her youth learning the craft and playing on the streets, even joining a team herself in her teenage years.
Everyone, this is my father, John Ellis. He was my first coach, probably my life coach.
Despite clearly being bitten by the soccer bug, Ellis initially tried to pursue other careers. And after getting her university degree, she scored a lucrative job writing telecommunications manuals. This was roughly as interesting as you'd expect, and she was bored to death, until she received a phone call from her father's old disciple, who wanted to hire her as an assistant soccer coach at the University of Maryland. With her father's support, Ellis accepted the job despite the significantly smaller salary and dove into the world of coaching. It's probably safe to say the risk was worth taking. Today, the U.S. team boss is the only coach who has won the Women's World Cup twice, and the team has only lost 7 of their 126 games under her.
We have athleticism, we have technique, and we have mentality. And I think those three combined, especially in a soccer team, make us pretty formidable.
With all the hype they're getting, it might be easy to think that the current U.S. Women's National Soccer Team is the best there has ever been. Only time will tell whether that's true, but as Bleacher Report attests, the excellency of the current crop doesn't take away from the fact that past versions of the team have also had plenty of uniquely talented players. Arguably, the finest player who has ever put on a U.S. women's team shirt is Mia Hamm, whose 158 international goals, 145 assists, and 2 FIFA Player of the Year awards, not to mention top spots at the 1991 and 99 Women's World Cups, and 96 and 2004 Olympics, made her the face of soccer in the U.S. for years. Abby Wambach's 184 goals, 77 of which were headers, are a record for an international player, and her dramatic equalizer against Brazil in 2011's World Cup played a part in popularizing women's soccer. There's Christine Lilly and her record 354 U.S. national team caps. Hope Solo, the confrontational goalkeeper who won Golden Gloves in 2 different World Cups and lost only 11 U.S. national games. Joy Fawcett, who is a reliable center back in 3 World Cups and 2 Olympics while acting as a head coach for UCLA, and the list goes on and on. It's probably fair to say that with the current interest in women's soccer, the future will see more than a few additions to these legends of the U.S. women's national team. Check out one of our newest videos right here, plus even more grunge videos about your favorite sports celebs are coming.
Okay, the story of women's soccer. Okay, we're going to have a short break, about 7 or 8 minutes now.